listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
On the next Voices for the Animals, we'll be speaking with Howard Garrett of the Orca Network about the plans to release Lolita, also known as Tokate, an orca who has lived in captivity performing for over 50 years.
The same people who are trying to splash cold water on the whole idea and discourage any talk of Toki coming home, they paint this picture of her as being, you know, really decrepit and couldn't possibly survive the journey, and that's just not true at all.
We'll also talk with Courtney Scott of In Defense of Animals about why our own Oregon Zoo has landed on their list of 10 worst zoos for elephants for the 12th year in a row.
Elephants are uniquely unsuited to captivity, and just by their size alone, they require miles to roam, and without that base, they literally suffer brain damage.
Don't make any summer plans that involve seeing animals in captivity until you listen to the next Voices for the Animals show, airing Friday, June 23rd at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
KBOO.
Yeah. It's really about enjoying yourself. That's all it is. Get in the breeze and let shit go. Check it out, y'all. I'm in the fast lane, smashing, passing REs. 95 degrees against the breeze. Unpredictable smoothness, my vehicle moves. Spectacular intergalactic cruise ship. The night at my back, there is no confusion. The wind in the road and the engine's music. All it really is something to do. It's part of how I live and it makes me cool. My brother had a Honda, uncle's Kawasaki. Kenny had a Harley, we was kids in Harvey. Malcolm, Hugh, Hampton, who are we? Ray Zone, B-Funk, Hendrix, and Harley. The cities, the trees and the mountains, the scene is pretty. The reasons I'm out here are far too many. The reasons you sweat me are both deep and petty. Despite danger and death, there are not in it. Reasons to slow down, momentum steady. I'm not leaving yet cause I'm not ready. I love my family and I love my life. I'm on top of my bike and it feels just right. You should go take a hike or fly a kite. Or find a way to do more of something you like. Man exuding rock and roll. It's the truth in the movement you cannot control. It's the mood and the music, it moves my soul. I'm one with the wind as the world unfolds. Some live to rise, some rise to live. I don't put this here before my wife and kids. When them patches fly, I know what time it is. The respect you earn is the respect I give. Fools set tripping, but it's not my steez. I came in peace and that's how I leave. If you got a death wish, then you best believe. If the night needs a victim, it won't be me. Heed the doctrines, proceed with caution. Before you go to war, explore your options. Cats chase coffins way too often. Was it God that called them or the crazy talking?
All right, y'all. This is Mike Crenshaw. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. Wherever you are on earth, you are tuned in to Culture in Motion. If you're in Portland listening to the radio, this is KBOO 90.7 FM, community radio, and we are KBOO.FM on Wi-Fi. And we talk about the intersection between art, culture, activism, politics, and music. And I want to start off today's show by saying that tomorrow I'm embarking on a magnificent, special, fantastic voyage with a brother that introduced me to this journey. Malcolm Shabazz Hoover, how you doing, bro?
Yay! I'm doing great. Life is beautiful.
It's a small town and a small community, and it's a small world. Those of you who live in Portland might be familiar with Malcolm Shabazz Hoover from the Black Food Sovereignty. Is it Network or Coalition?
Coalition.
Coalition and Black Futures Farm. And you guys are, if you're listening to Culture in Motion, you know me and all the different things that I'm involved with. Malcolm, tell us about the vision you had, where it came from. I know you've been talking about it a lot lately.
Yeah.
How was this vision for Crenshaw and Shabazz, which was going to be Malcolm Rides America?
Yeah.
Now Crenshaw and Shabazz and the homie Tom. What up, Tom Tegner? Shout out to him.
What's up? What's up to the homie Tom, to our crew, Liquid Real, Ian, Josh, our amazing director, Donnell, emphasis on amazing. How did it come about? Well, I first started riding back in 2015, I think it was.
When you say riding, what are you talking about?
Ride motorcycles.
Okay.
I found a picture the other day of me on my first bicycle.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm gonna upload it to our website.
Okay.
I found a picture the other day of me on my first bicycle.
Yeah.
And so I'm gonna say it started back then because my connection to the road into like this thing that riding a motorcycle is to me,
yeah,
has always been with me, even when I just had a bicycle.
Yep.
You know, like that physical connection to the road, using all four extremities to control yourself, the meditation that I get when I'm moving, all that has been with me since the first time I learned to ride a bicycle. My deep love of human beings and my feeling this obligation I have to bring people closer together has something that has always also always been with me. About 2015, so almost 10 years ago, 8 years ago, is when I got my first motorcycle. I had a Honda Shadow A750 in 1996, I think it was. Maybe 98. My memory is bad these days. But yeah, 98 Honda Shadow Ace that I got from a Navy buddy. Sat in my backyard for a cold minute. Like, finally my landlord was like, do something with it. I got it fixed up. I didn't even really know how to ride. The cats who fixed it for me also taught me how to ride, took me out in San Francisco. And so my first solo ride was in rush hour traffic across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco to Oakland. It was crazy. And I was completely in love.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is it. This is it. I don't want to do nothing else.
Right.
And I just decided then, like, riding around Oakland, and like I took the bike the next day to LA, which was insane. Was not like a smart decision.
Did you take I-5? Did you take
I went down five. I just went down five. And I didn't even intend to go to LA. I was just kinda like, man, I was like, oh, maybe I'll ride to Santa Cruz. And then I got to Santa Cruz, and I was like, yo, maybe I'll ride to Santa Barbara.
Right.
And then when I got to Santa Barbara, I was like, why not go to L.A.?
Yeah.
The hard part is already done.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it was great. And I just really love the road, and I love the people that I meet on the road. And so the idea came from just meeting these really beautiful people who weren't at all what they look like. And people wanting to talk to me all the time because I had this weird Honda Shadow. It had like a red, black, and green / Captain America theme on it, you know?
It was already painted like that.
No, they rattle canned it.
Okay, the brothers you got it from?
Yeah. No, yeah. Not when I got it, it was like just blue.
Yeah, yeah.
And black. And yeah. Then I handed it over to these dudes, and I got it back 3 weeks later, and they had rattle canned it red, black, and green, and put like a weird star on the tank, and
yeah.
Had taped over the hole in the seat. It was perfect for me. It was wow. Like, beat the hell out of this thing.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, I just fell in love, and I kept meeting these people, and I was like, oh, like this could really be a thing.
Hmm.
And I had just finished a book too, so like, I was into like touring mode.
Mm.
Yeah, I just and that's where the idea came from. I was gonna take a year, get a GoPro and like just some regular cameras, you know, just DSLR or whatever, and go to coffee shops and just talk to people and be like, hey, can we have a conversation about America? And yeah, so I, you know, that bike got ripped off. I moved up to Portland. Took me a little while to get another bike. I got another bike. I traded that in. I got this hog. And then I think you and me were hanging out one day, and I was like, Mike, Spirit just told me, like, tell Mike,
mm-hmm.
you know, invite mm-hmm. Mike. And so well, you I know, always listen to Spirit.
Well, what's the trip is that I remember meeting you the first time because I rode by you. We were actually friends on Facebook
yeah.
before we met in person.
Yeah.
And we knew a lot of the same people, yep. not just yep. in Portland, but from all over the country, East yeah. Coast, West Coast, down South. And some of the people that you knew and were connected to were people I hadn't seen for 20, 30 years. And I'm like, because a lot of brothers moved to the Bay
yeah.
that I used to kick it with in Chicago, Minneapolis, and then y'all got tied out there. So you knew who I was when you saw me on my bike and you said, man, I want to get an Indian. And right. we started talking bikes. And that right. was close to a decade ago.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's trippy how time Man. Flies. I want to circle back for a second on Malcolm because you said something really important, and I think this is people often ask me what's it like to ride a motorcycle, and for me too, it does go back to riding bicycles. There was something magic when I was a kid and I moved around a lot. There was something magic about getting on a bike and getting lost and then finding my way home.
Yeah,
because that was the way I became acquainted with my new neighborhood.
Yeah.
And if I could do that, once I made friends in the neighborhood, if I could do that with a group of friends, that was the most liberating thing.
Yep.
And I remember we sometimes gather a group of 20, 30 kids, and then eventually when the sun would go down, people would start to go, well, I got to go home.
Right.
And then the kid who was close to that kid would be like, well, if they're going home, I got to go home.
Right.
And then I would start, my heart would sink because all the kids would slowly fade away.
Right.
Then I'd be left by myself.
Right.
But then I ride back home by myself, and I realize that there's something about riding a bicycle at night.
Mm.
You feel like you're going faster than you do if you ride it in the daylight. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. So I grew up in Philly.
Yeah.
And that's perfect.
Yeah.
Because growing up in Philly, I grew up in a neighborhood called West Oak Lane that is all the way at the northwest corner of the city. It's the last neighborhood you're in before you leave the city and go into like the suburbs. If you could call it a suburb, Cheltenham is just like a upgraded hood. it's just a hood in another county in Montgomery County, right?
Right.
So, but we would ride from Center City, which is downtown Philly, all the way home to my neighborhood. It's like a 2-hour ride.
Wow.
You know? And if you ride it at night and the streets are not empty, but they're emptier.
Yeah.
And the streets and the light and the smell, especially after it rained.
Mm.
You know, like, it would just have this magic quality.
Yeah.
And we would always just see stuff. And we never stopped. Like, there were no, like, we weren't stopping in the lights or, we just, nah, that just was the whole thing. Just mob.
Yeah, yeah.
So for 2 hours, you know, me and my cousins or me and my friends from school, sometimes I had a teacher, shout out to Miss Hicks at Ivy Leaf Middle School, who would, you know, I was in her sixth grade class. And sometimes on Saturdays, she would come by with her bicycle.
Yeah.
And her son, Teddy, and they would pick up all the kids in the sixth grade, and we would go on a mass ride.
Wow.
Yeah, so it would be like 30, 40 kids, because we were small classes.
Yeah.
And we would just ride the city together, and Mrs. Hicks would buy us lunch, or sometimes we would pack sandwiches and go to Fairmount Park and hang out. But that nighttime ride, oh, there's just nothing like that.
I feel like, you know, we'll get back to motorcycles in a minute, but I feel like if I look at the span of human contributions in terms of inventions, vehicles especially, I think that the bicycle is one of the greatest inventions in human history.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
I sometimes dream about, you know, if we ever get ourselves off fossil fuel, and you know, spare Africa from a war for precious and rare earth metals to fuel, you know, your Tesla and get off our addiction to phones. What if we move to a global bicycle, you know, paradigm?
Yeah.
You could still travel. We figure out ways to get overseas, but when you got there, you just ride a bike. You know?
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we're about to ride our motorcycles.
But in the meantime, we hogging.
So tell the people about our mission.
In the meantime, we are hogging.
We're about to ride out of here.
Yeah, man.
Where are we going, Malcolm?
Yeah, so we have a pretty epic road trip planned. We are leaving Portland. We're going to overnight in Redding. And then we're going to mash to Sonoma, where we're going to interview Hannah Mae Rhee.
She's been on Culture Motion before. Black Banjo Reclamation. Look her up.
Yep. So we're going to sit and kick it with that sister, who I understand is 9 months pregnant.
She's about to have a baby, y'all.
Yeah, about to bring new life into the world. We were going to try to hook up with my sister Pandora, who is the person who opened Earthseed Farm. She's a legendary permaculturalist. Hopefully, I'll be able to catch Pan on the way back. I've known her over 20 years as my good sister. And then we're going to hog to the Bay, to Oakland, hang out in Oakland, hopefully talk to a club down there. And some other people, and then early in the morning we're going to Silverado, California, in the LA area, to the Born Free Custom Motorcycle Show.
I've been wanting to go to Born Free for years. We're talking about motorcycles that look like wedding cakes.
I'm excited.
In terms of the paint, the custom paint, the engineering, motorcycles that look like Jolly Ranchers.
Wow.
Right. We're talking about candy machines that are functional and actually ride.
Wow.
Like you can turn them on and you can actually ride them.
Wow.
And there's going to be hundreds of motorcycles builders from all over the country. So the reason the platform in which we're doing this is called Crenshaw and Shabazz. And if you were to go online and you were to search, there's actually, this is not a call to action, but this is just making people aware, there's actually a GoFundMe, because there's three cameras, there's lighting, there's a director, and there's three people riding. That's you, Malcolm Shabazz Hoover, myself, and Tom Tegner. So we're going to be filming this for a motorcycle documentary called Crenshaw and Shabazz and the Homie Tom. And we're going to be using motorcycles. We're using motorcycles as a platform to talk about race. A lot of times when we think about motorcycle culture, especially outlaw motorcycle culture, club culture, we think exclusively about white men. There's a connotation, there's a trope, a stereotype that it's right-wing, conservative, reactionary, racist white men. But the fact of the matter is, historically, there's a lot of us who participate in this culture. Shout out to Kirsten Madura, who basically explained to us, you know, Engines for Change is her nonprofit, explained to us that women are the fastest growing demographic in the motorcycling world. So even though we're all men, our love of motorcycles is gonna be the platform through which we talk to people who don't fit the stereotype of people who love riding their motorcycles.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what it's been the magic to me, is like really seeing people unlock and unfold who I don't really have a lot in common with. You know, I'm a farmer, I work in local government as a community engagement professional. I've been a school teacher. You know, I like to think of myself as a regular working class person.
Yeah.
So we have that in common, but culturally, we don't really have a lot. When we get around these bikes, people unfold and unlock and they reveal themselves, because you have a common love of a thing.
Yeah.
And so if I love a thing and you love a thing, we love a thing in common, and we could probably, so that means we're alike in a lot of important ways.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's hard to love.
Yeah.
It's hard to love.
Hmm.
And if human beings can find things that they love in common, that gives them common ground to discuss very difficult things, potentially.
Right.
So that also was the genesis of it, is like, people don't, for the most part, if you're not actively doing organizing or some kind of coalition work, the skill set that you have to do that work is not cultivated.
Yeah.
And it's a specialized skill set.
Yeah.
And I came by it vicariously myself, but after having done this work for 36 years of coalition building, of organizing, you know, across a lot of different contexts, I realized that I have a skill set that I want to share.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the way for me, that the most expeditious way to, who says that expeditiously? T.I.?
You said it. This is the second time I've heard you say it.
Okay,
so you probably say it.
I like the word. Yes, I like expeditiously. It's a good word. So an expeditious way to do it, to expedite the process, to make it quicker, to spread it out. Like, people like media, right?
Yeah.
And so was to create a media vehicle through which people could watch me engage in this process, right? Intentionally.
Yeah.
I enter into these conversations intentionally. And then watch me navigate them with other people, right? So now it's you, me, and Tom who are going to navigate these situations together, all the while holding joy at the center and like a common love, but also holding my boundaries and being strong and that all the never compromising myself.
Mm-hmm.
How we do that can impact a lot of people, because then other people could be like, oh, I could also stand in my truth, you know, and still exercise love for people and talk about things I want to talk about.
Right.
Even if it's awkward, I can move through it.
Right.
Right. And so I really believe that this could be an offering.
Mm.
This could be a way for people to learn and experience things that we're going to experience vicariously. It's going to give them confidence to like have these conversations themselves. Right. And learn and have some insight to a culture that is more, that is really important to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that I really feel like it's going to be a gift.
Yeah.
You know, not just to me, because my life is already changed by it.
Yeah.
But by people who watch it and regard it, it's going to be a gift in terms of the quality of the production, right? We're not some weird reality show thing. It's like a real experience of people doing real things and, you know, and having a good time while they do it.
Yeah.
So I'm excited, bro. Like I know people can hear it in my voice, but I'm very excited about it, and I'm really excited to do it with you.
I'm glad you invited me to be part of it, because I love what I do and I do what I love, but that doesn't mean it's easy.
It's
motorcycles have been a way for me to engage in a meditative, liberatory process that really can change the whole way I feel about life and myself and people that I have to interact with in about 20 minutes. Without, you know, completely sober, you know, and you know, Harley Davidson's, they're an investment, but it's one of those investments that keeps giving back to me. Now, people talk about the danger of it and the safety of it. What do you have to say about the fact that you can be harmed, you could be maimed, and you could die doing what you love? What do you have to say to people who are concerned about that?
I say I'm a black man in America, and there's nothing more dangerous than being a black man in America.
Okay.
First thing.
Okay.
Right? And so all the things that come along with living in this body are things that I have cultivated. Even if people don't notice it, I always have situational awareness.
Right.
I always know who and what is around me. I always know where the outs are. I'm always prepared to engage in combat.
Mm.
Always. And I'm always prepared to escape. So getting on a motorcycle to me offers me a faster way to escape. Right. And so, sure, people don't always see you, you know, I can't count how many times a day, if I wasn't looking, you know, four or five car lengths ahead through other car, through their rear window and the rear windows of
see
the cars ahead of them.
At.
Yeah.
Yes.
And looking around and, you know, looking around the vehicle and looking in my mirrors, like crazy things are always happening. People are on their phones, they're not paying attention, they're certainly not looking for you. Your profile doesn't fit their memory map of what a vehicle is, so they're not looking for you, right? So yeah, it's dangerous, but life is dangerous. And it gives me an extreme amount of joy.
That's right.
And at this point in my life, I'm unwilling to compromise my joy for being afraid. I'm just not gonna do it. I've never lived my life that way, and I refuse to live my life that way now.
That's what's up. So, you know, I've been in a couple of near-death experiences. The first was I was hit by a car when I was 7. Shout out to my auntie, Wanda Simpson. And she was there. She saved my life. I was on a bicycle. And the second, I got in a really bad motorcycle wreck. And at both those, you know, junctures, I had the opportunity to consider, am I going to quit? And I think, you know, this might sound stupid to some people, but when I went over my handlebars on my motorcycle in 2019 and tore every ligament in my knee, and I woke, you know, I came to on my back, And I looked at my knee, and it was the size of a soccer ball.
Oof.
And I knew I couldn't get up. Oof. But I knew that I was okay because I wiggled my toes and I wasn't paralyzed.
Right.
And the immediate thought was, how's my bike?
Right. Right.
Because I knew I was going to ride. I would have rolled out of there if I could have.
Right.
But I couldn't.
Right.
You know, and
right.
So the joy and the love has always been greater than the fear.
Yeah.
And the reluctance. I want to take a musical break. Well, at the top of the hour, we listened to Free My Mind. Big shout out to Red Ray Frazier, who was singing on that, and Prince Elwood Strickland III over there at Portland Underground Recording, who mixed that song. And next, we're going to get into this joint called Born to Fight. And it addresses some of the things you brought about, always ready for combat,
mm-hmm.
but always ready to de-escalate, too.
Always
ready to always ready to wage peace because always. Nobody wants to get hurt, y'all.
Nobody does, and I don't want to hurt you. In combat situations, one of the first things I learned to say is try to de-escalate, walk away, try to walk away, and then say to the person, "Hey, look, I don't want to get hurt, and I don't want to hurt you."
Yeah.
Like, can we? I'm sorry I offended you. You know, I'm gonna go this way, and then just try to leave.
Yeah.
You know,
but keep your eyes on them. Don't
yeah,
turn
oh,
your
yeah,
back.
Don't turn your back.
Yeah.
You know, back away.
Yeah.
You know, with your hands up. But, like, I mean, wage peace.
Yeah.
You know, and do that with love. Even if you have to engage in combat, to be gentle with your opponent, you know, if you master them physically, to be gentle with them.
Yeah.
And to
when,
be merciful.
When they're down
compassion.
And unconscious, you don't need to keep
no
at it.
Don't hurt people more than necessary.
Yeah.
In order to keep yourself safe.
Right.
Yeah. So always have compassion.
Mm.
You know, even for people who don't have compassion for you.
Right.
You know, and like that's the way. This is the way, right? Like the Mandalorian, this is the way.
Mm. Word. Let's listen to Born to Fight. We'll be back.
How did it be fluid every
Hey, y'all, that was Born to Fight. Big shout out to Ajay Marshall, who wrote that track, played all the instruments. Again, recorded at Portland Underground Recording. If you search Mike Crenshaw Born to Fight on YouTube, you're going to see a dope video directed by Ian Westmoreland. Shout out to Ian. Ian is rolling with us. He's on the camera crew. He's our lead camera on his documentary. But before we get into the conversation again, you guys, I want to thank some of the donors. Ben Morad, Christine Washburn, Natasha Kamashta, Direct English, Michael Boston, Melissa Soul, Allison Stewart, Tim Cook, Patch Perryman, Constance Bracewell, all the anonymous donors, Robert Hoover, and on and on. You guys are helping us get down the road. It's very expensive. Gas is like, I mean, motorcycles are more fuel efficient, but gas is, you know, five. We put premium in our bikes because we take care of it. $5 a gallon. Everybody's got to eat.
Hotels
are expensive.
Yeah, just general money that it costs to pay people every day because they're not working for free.
Right.
Yeah, or the crew is not donating their labor, which is fine. They shouldn't. We got really highly skilled people to do this work. We got a publicist. Like, when I first came out with this idea, it was honestly just going to be me and some GoPros and $500 till I ran out of money.
Right. And you could have done fine with it.
Yeah. But it wouldn't have been this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It wouldn't have been this. And so, also, it's taken, this has been like a leap of faith,
mm-hmm.
you know, because this is like when I wrote my book, you know, this was like when we created the farm. Mm-hmm. This is something that's really close to my heart, that to share with other people and to give other people like control over this thing or even like meaningful input has really been a continual exercise for me and like stepping back and trusting and prayer and meditation and like deep listening.
Mm.
And so I welcome that because it's grown me a lot.
Yeah.
It's grown me a lot. And I've really learned a lot just even in this short process. And it hasn't really been short, but to share it and to watch your thing grow, you know, and to become other people's thing, you know, so that it's really just been beautiful. Like if you want a thing to grow, share it with people around you.
So this is a practice for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't the first time you've done this.
No.
The times that you've done this prior have probably given you a degree of, what would be the word? Is it confidence? About the taking something from inception to manifestation to actualization, visualization to actualization.
Oh, yeah.
Having faith.
Yep.
These are things that people associate with spirituality. Can you talk about that?
Come on now, bro.
You're
playing with me.
I need you to.
It's serious.
Express. It's serious. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we come from spirit,
right?
We're spiritual beings having a physical experience. That's the real power.
Mm-hmm.
This is the meat suit. Our body is just our space suit. This is not me or us.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's all things. It's making a sentence. It's writing words. It's anything that you see in your mind, you can create in real life.
Yeah.
You know, you can bring it out of your mind and make it into a real physical thing. And we do it every day. You do it when you talk, because when you vocalize, the sound waves are physical. Like they're a physical thing. You're changing the world around you.
Right.
Even just by talking.
Right.
So this is the third thing that I've done more than three things, but this is the third kind of big thing I've manifested. The first thing was a book. Mm. So I wrote a book. It's called 144 Poems and Essays for God, Love, Truth, Justice, Peace, and Hip Hop. It was published in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And that book is a compilation of like all my favorite poems and essays.
So people can get that online or?
It's actually, unfortunately, it's out of print. But if you're interested, if you hit me on my Instagram, Malcolm313, MALCOLM. 313, I can email you a PDF and you can read it, or when we reprint it in the fall, like September, October, it should be reprinted by then, because it's at an editor now. Okay. But I'm just taking it slow. I'm gonna republish it and I could put you on the list of people and I'll reach out to you.
Right.
But it's out there. It came out and then the publisher went under and da da, long story. Second thing is my farm, Black mm-hmm. Futures Farm, which is at Southeast 60th and Duke, between Duke and Flavelle. And when I started farming and we started Black Futures Farm, I knew that it was going to be successful and good. I didn't know what it was going to become. I didn't see that it was going to become the community program that it is becoming and has become, with this deep impact on our community here in Portland. I didn't see that we were going to be feeding hundreds of people. I didn't see that we were going to get like a multi-million dollar grant, or we were going to get millions of dollars in grant money. I didn't see any of that. I didn't see that I was going to meet the woman who I married right. through farming. I met my wife. Shout out to Mirabai.
What's up, Mirabai?
It's our 3-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I love you, babe. You're the best. My wife and I actually got married on our farm. I didn't see that it was going to transform not just my life, but the lives of my community, you know, and people who participate. I couldn't have seen any of that. I just knew that it was going to be good. And I feel the same way about this project, that it's good. And Spirit told me it was going to be good, you know, and I always listen to Spirit. Always, 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 always. I'm wearing right now a necklace that is symbolic to Ishu, and Ishu is the waymaker and the person who guards the crossroads. Mm. It's the spirit in the Orisha that guards the crossroads. And so this was given to me as a wedding gift by my brother Charles Hanna, Third Eye Books. Big shout out to Third Eye. They're actually in Jamaica right now celebrating. Mm. Charles and Michelle. And you know, Ishu guards the way.
Yeah.
And protects the way. And so, you know, we're about to get on the road.
Yeah.
So please, you know, protect us. Yeah. We need your protection. But I always listen to Spirit. I've always been a spiritual person, always. I've had several near-death experiences. I drowned when I was a child, and I got to be out of my body and see myself get revived.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Deep.
Yeah.
Real deep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always lived, like, in the world of the invisible.
Right,
which is the real world to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the more material world that makes more sense than this physical world that is irrational and greedy and weird.
Yeah, it's a trip because I feel you on every syllable, you know, and I always have felt similarly. That's why we're brothers, and the alchemy of existence is nothing short of what would be the word. It's everywhere. And so sometimes when we talk to folks, people say things like, oh, you're so deep. And I'm like, we're all deep. You know, our existence comes from, we're surrounded by darkness, you know? And so to even be here is, and be self-aware in community with not just other human beings, right? But other species and other elements. It's a pretty fascinating thing. The question is, you know, how did we wind up in a situation where it seems like a small group of folks have orchestrated something that holds so many people captive? We don't have to get in. That's just the question.
No, I want to get into it.
Okay.
I want to get into it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so as an African person, as a descendant of Africans, of captives, you know, we just passed Juneteenth. I think about this a lot.
Yeah.
I think about this a lot. How do we get in a situation where African people of African descent, were the first modern human beings on the planet, the fathers and mothers of civilization? You know, the Black woman is the only human being, is the only being on Earth that possesses the Eve gene, which is the gene that gives them the capability to produce all other human beings. You know, the African genetic diversity is the most, we have the most genetic diversity even within African people than all other people combined apart. I might have more genetically in common with somebody from Sweden than I do with another African person because we're so old.
Mm-hmm.
We're so old. So how is it that people with dark skin, that melanated people, people of African descent, all those different categories, how is it that we became to be the lowest at every category? How did it come to be that we're the most exploited,
right,
the most reviled,
right?
You know, the most of all the base things. How did we get here?
Mm-hmm.
It can't be by accident.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be by our nature,
right?
Because we are also simultaneously some of the most loving, forgiving, gentle, beautiful, peaceful people on the planet,
right?
how did white supremacy as a system, to name it, right, which is the same thing that fuels white supremacy, is a thing that fuels transphobia, is a thing that fuels homophobia, is a thing that fuels patriarchy. It's all this system. It's a system that teaches us that we are different at base, and that some people are more than other people, that some people deserve more by right.
Well, you just said that the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
You just said that you just said the black woman was the only one who had this capacity.
That's science.
Okay.
That's not my opinion.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's not me opining, and that's what it is. That's okay. Not, if it was somebody else, I would say that.
Right.
You know, I just happen to be the son of a black woman.
Right.
You know? So that's what I'm talking about. And I'm not saying that people should be bowing down on black people. That's not at all what I'm saying. But I'm saying that we have this myth that black people are less than, and it's been perpetrated and like promoted, and it's just a lie. It's just it's a lie, but the lie is so powerful that even we believe it.
Right.
Many of us, you know, and that we perpetrate it on each other. Like, oh, I'm dark, you know, you're like lighter than me.
Mm-hmm. So I'm supposed to be close to better.
Right.
Closer to better.
Supposed to be.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this thing that we see, that you see anti-blackness and colorism in all societies.
Yeah.
Right? In all societies, the darker people are the less desirable people.
Mm-hmm.
The people in Italy who live below Rome are like, you know, the less civilized people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the darker people in Turkey are somehow the less civilized people.
Sub-Saharan Africa.
Right.
The first peoples on any continent are at the bottom of the caste system on that continent.
So how did that happen?
Yeah. Right.
How did that happen? But Europe has been systematically exploiting Africa for at least 1,000 years.
Yeah.
At least 1,000 years.
More than
years.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
Systematically exploiting Africa and its people.
Right.
You know, and it didn't even begin with the Portuguese and the people in Angola, when the king of Portugal decided that the people who were at court with him, because they kept bringing all this gold, were going to suddenly be exploited. I'm still trying to figure out how the Moors ruled Portugal and Spain up until 1492. Ferdinand and Isabella sent Columbus and his people over here, well, not even over here, to what is now the Dominican Republic in Haiti.
Yeah.
Where'd they get that money from?
Yeah.
And was that when they discovered all those riches, was that what they used to fuel their war against the Moors? And do we really believe that the Moors occupied Spain and Portugal for 800 years and they got rid of all the Moors? How did that, where'd they go?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting to think about when I hear these narratives that are factual about history, you know, it's written about, you know, it's not just talked about, you know, in oral tradition when people get together and say things, but it's written down in European books, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So one of the things that always interests me is that there's more than one thing going on. We're talking about anti-blackness, colorism, casteism, racism, white supremacy, most melanated people on the bottom. But we also can see evidence where melanated people participated, okay, in the expansion, the growth of certain kinds of trade that created a lot of wealth and consolidation of wealth for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
So there seems to be this behavioral element where people were socialized because capitalism developed in concert, simultaneously, inextricably linked to white supremacy.
Yeah.
Because it was all about the trade and consolidated wealth, private property, extraction of resources, be they human resources through slave trading or natural resources. So this is something that people will point this out. They say, well, this happened in Africa. There was an Arab slave trade.
Yeah.
There was a Muslim slave trade, which is how a lot of West African, North African people became Muslim.
Yep.
A lot of people who came through the slave trade to this landmass were Muslim people.
Yep, absolutely.
However, historically, a lot of those people were animist people before these other religions were introduced.
Yeah.
So I think I say all that to say that I think there's something about the desire to have more.
That's human.
Than somebody else.
Yeah, that's human.
That can be exploited.
Yeah, that's not particular to any one group of people.
Right.
I would say a particular people, the Europeans, particularly the royal family and the European elite, have mastered it. But, you know, the richest one, the richest man in the world is in Africa.
Yeah.
Always. You know, because he's mastered exploitation of his own people.
Right.
And the distinction that I like to make when people talk about African and Arab slavery, the word slave comes from Slav, mm-hmm. the Slavic people, because the Slavic people were the first people that Europe brought into bondage.
Mm-hmm.
And they took so many of the Slavs into bondage, they built a wall and a barrier against the Western European invaders, and they murdered everybody who tried to come close to the wall. So, like, they have a very serious and deep history, but that is old. It's older than African European history, slavery. And it's mm-hmm. the reason, even now in Europe, why they treat Eastern Europeans differently than they treat Western Europeans. Mm-hmm. It's related to a very old system of exploitation. But to go back to our system, right, the system right. that was imposed on us, chattel slavery, which was an inherited status, right, is different than the slavery that was practiced in Arab and European in Arab slavery and African slavery, right? Even though Arab slavery was still pretty, could have lasted generations, but usually you could, especially if you were Muslim, you could graduate out of slavery and be more like an indentured servant. So you had less status, for sure, because you had been enslaved, but they didn't take your humanity away from you. There was a station above which you could not go. But even that, you know, I was raised as a Christian. That's in the Bible. Like, Moses, right, who came from somewhere south of Egypt, we don't know where, but if you look on a map and you look south of Egypt, like Uganda, mm-hmm. the Sudan,
mm-hmm.
I ain't seen no white folks down there yet.
Sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah. He was from somewhere south of there, you know, the Nubians. And they said he looked like so much like Pharaoh, la, la, la. But he was never allowed to have the status that Pharaoh's family had because he came from who they perceived to be inferior, you know? And chattel slavery was a system of slavery where you inherited your parents' status.
Right.
Your parents were slaves, you became a slave, and so on and so on and so on. So here in you know, Northern America and in Caribbean and Latin America and South America, we have like generations and generations and generations, like maybe as many as 30 generations in some families of bondage.
Yeah.
And exploitation.
And this is facts.
Yeah, that's
this isn't conjecture.
No.
These are the kind of facts that are being banned from being distributed and available when there's a war on critical race theory.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's a war on, you know, other rights and freedoms that are supposed to be part of being born in this country, right?
Yeah, America's being dumbed down.
Okay.
You know, I had the benefit of a great education as a young person.
Right.
In a family, I come from a black nationalist family, so like that informs my rhetoric and the way I think. Shout out to Black Panther Party for self-defense. You know, like that was the way I was raised.
Right.
And so to know these things about not just my history, but to be able to have an appreciation of other people's history is really important to me, you know, so especially so I can know where we have our common ground,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I can work to build common ground with people who would and we should be allies.
I'm going to give a shout out to some local folks who've supported us recently.
Yes, please do.
CC.
Yep.
And Rudy's Barbershop out there in Beaverton.
Yep.
Ship John out there on 43rd and South East Division. Big shout out to Mike, Holly,
and Steven.
And Steven and the good people at Ship John. If you want to get some good gear, then you might want to take a look in there. And they blessed us with some gear to take on the road.
Fitted.
shout out to Spider and Chris over there at Cycle Tune.
Yeah.
Who tuned Tom and my bike up real nice. Shout out to Paradise Harley Davidson.
Shout out to Volcano Harley Davidson.
Shout out to Major League Lane Splitter. Shout out to OG Mooch and Mondays with Mooch. So many people to name, but this is community. So we're taking the show on the road to Born Free Custom Motorcycle Show in Orange County, Silverado, California. But eventually, we're going to shoot and edit this first episode. But eventually, Malcolm, the vision is to take this show around the whole country and to talk with people about these things that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because historically, there's more than one side. There's more than your perspective.
Absolutely.
There are people who their generational experience came from the other side of this perspective that you're talking about.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And you want to be able to talk. So if your last name is Hoover, historically, what does that denote?
I mean, you know, I'm a Hoover. We're from North Carolina. There's a famous family. They built a dam. They had a couple presidents. they got a vacuum cleaner company. Mm. You know, they're very wealthy. And that family was the owner of my family, where I got my name from. And I've had some experiences with, you know, my white cousins, as we affectionately call them. Some have been pleasant. Some have been notoriously unpleasant. I had a neighbor who had a grandmother who was in my family. She was quite wealthy and was playing poverty, and I was actually still really poor, and we lived in the same building, and I found out that her family owned my family, and she stopped talking to me, you know? And I didn't ask her for no reparations. I didn't ask her to run me my bread, even though I knew that she was a trust fund baby. I wanted to have the conversation, you know? By the same token, I had a conversation with the gentleman who had been the immediate past president of the University of North Carolina, who they built the Hoover Pavilion, same family, talked to him. He was lovely and wonderful, and said, if you're ever in North Carolina and in Charlotte, let's have dinner and talk about it. You know, I'll tell you the whole family history. So, you know, like, America has we have a lot of problems. And one of our fundamental problems is this race thing. We're like, I always say, what if America was really trying to be America? What if America was really trying to be like land of the free, home of the brave? What if America really embraced, you know, the Ellis Island philosophy of like, give us your tired, your weak, your poor, the thing that's on the Statue of Liberty? What if we were really about that? What if we are really as a country about doing the right thing? Like, what if we are really as a nation about pursuing righteousness? What would our daily lives look like? If we were really about taking care of the poor, if we were really about like being America, if we were really living our stated values, what would this country be like? And as somebody who has a conflicted relationship with, you know, I'm a veteran, I'm a Navy veteran, has a conflicted relationship with this country, what I want most is for America to confront itself. Mm. And I'm happy. If America confronts itself and does so honestly, I'm convinced that the good people in America will have the dominant voice. The reasonable people will have the dominant voice. But right now, we're not allowing the reasonable people to have any kind of voice. Mm-hmm. Everybody doesn't have the same understanding of issues. Another reason I want to do this is because I want to suss it out. I want to talk to people who don't necessarily agree, but we can find common ground to have respectful discussion. And maybe when we part, we still won't agree. But I will have learned something, and they will have learned something, and hopefully we will part with more understanding and respect than we walk into the room with.
Again, you guys, that the name of the project is Crenshaw and Shabazz. That's where you're going to find it online. Is it CrenshawandShabazz.com?
It is.
And the longer name is Crenshaw and Shabazz and the homie Tom. Little word about the homie Tom. I've been knowing Tom for 30 years. I came to Portland, anti-racist skinhead from the Minneapolis Baldies crew, co-founder of Anti-Racist Action, wanting to live a life of meaning, but not continually invite violence into my life. And I met Tom, you know, as part of that community, and Tom has figured out ways to continue to organize and fight racism as somebody that's of European descent. And he's coming along on the ride with us. And Tom knows, you know, Tom grew up in a skinhead culture. So Tom grew up riding scooters and, you know, eventually graduated to motorcycles. Three of us are riding the same bike. We're going to have a lot of fun. You guys follow Crenshaw and Shabazz on Instagram. You get to see some pictures. Malcolm Rides America. And is there anything you want to leave the people with before we get out of here on Culture Emotion?
Just to say thank you, bro. Like, I love you. I'm so grateful for you. Just as my friend and my brother, like, steel sharpens steel. So that's the first thing I want to say. I want to say, of all the people who are praying people, like, you know, whatever deity you pray to or not, like, put the good energy in the air for us to keep us safe, to keep us surrounded. Pray that, you know, that the ancestors and the angels watch over us, that they open the road before us and protect the road behind us, that we have clear skies and clear roads and an open road. And, you know, tap in. Like, check us out on all our socials. Malcolm Rides America, Crenshaw and Shabazz, or Crenshaw Shabazz on Instagram, CrenshawandShabazz.com. We have a Facebook page under the same name. Tap in. Become part of our community. We can't do this by ourselves. We actually really do need more people to participate. And, yeah, just look out for us. And if you have good ideas, holler at us, you know. And thank you. I'm just incredibly grateful for all of this.
Yeah.
I'm incredibly grateful, and I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. So thank you guys for listening to Culture in Motion. And keep, you know, if you're not a member of KBOO, please become a member of KBOO. Go to KBOO.fm and donate. And maybe even do that monthly, or do that on a quarterly basis. And or just, you know, do a one-time donation. And like my man Malcolm said, follow us on the socials. Laura, thank you for board opping for us. And I think we're going to be out of here. So... y'all have a good night. Peace.
Peace.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.